You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Thanks very much for that. I'm glad you're here. You know, you can always subscribe at Apple or at the Spotify. The interviews and the podcast also is at WGNradio.com. So if you sign up, you won't miss anything. You won't miss anyone like Melanie Benjamin. She's made a career out of writing historical fiction with stories that largely center around women, from the Swans of Fifth Avenue, maybe to the Aviator's Wife. You read that, perhaps, Mrs. Tom Thumb. Melanie has given us fictional accounts of our nonfiction world, and her latest, The Windsor Affair, is absolutely delicious. Melanie, welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
How about it? I mean, it's just, how does it feel? The book's coming out, the reviews are coming in. Is this a tense time for you?
No. You know, I've done this before. This is my 9th historical novel. So, it's, you know, the work's done. Like, now you just kind of get to enjoy the ride.
How did you find yourself writing historical fiction?
By accident, truly by accident. I published a couple of contemporary novels back in the early mid-2000s, like around 2005. And they didn't do very well, to be honest. And my publisher dropped me. And I was kind of trying to, and they weren't books that I would have read either. They were just kind of books to get me published. And then in retrospect, they really weren't, I would not have been happy continuing to write those books. So for a few years, I was just trying to find my way back into publishing. And I accidentally one day, I lived in the suburbs at the time, and I took the train into the Art Institute, and there was a traveling exhibit there called Dreaming in Pictures, the Photography of Lewis Carroll. Mm-hmm. It was down in the basement room at the Art Institute, you know, where they usually have special exhibits. And I went in there and I discovered this crazy world of Lewis Carroll, who had photographed this little girl named Alice Little. And she was the inspiration for Alice in Wonderland. And I just, you know, I just remember thinking, boy, I wonder what happened there, because I knew there was some kind of scandal attached to the relationship. And I thought it would be a really good novel, and I wrote it. I didn't realize it was historical fiction. My agent told me it was. And I just thought it was a really good story about a real thing. I love history. So the idea that I could combine my love of storytelling and imagining grounded in some real facts really appealed to me, and that's where it began.
So something I don't think I realized, that we've talked a few times, obviously, or that you came to this sort of later in life than most writers do.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, we're old.
but you know, you had a couple of boys, and were the boys out of the house when you started writing?
They were firmly in middle school kind of years.
Okay.
So the bulk of the parenting was, I mean, obviously it's still there, but they weren't in the house. So that is kind of when I started writing, when I had really found myself at loose ends. I had been in the theater. That was my background up until when I had children. And I found myself after the crazy young child years were over, and I did the PTA parent thing, and never do that again. I answered the phone one day and found myself president of the PTA. Don't do that, people. Then I really kind of felt at a loss creatively. And a friend of mine around that time told me, I always thought you'd be a writer. And I was a huge reader. The number one thing you need to do to be a writer is to just be an enormous reader. And it all kind of made sense. And writing had always come very easily to me in school. Didn't study it, but whenever I had to write, it was just, you know, easy, easy A, essay portion of the SAT, easy, easy, easy. It just kind of all fell into place.
Did you read the recent biography of Judy Blume?
Oh, gosh, no, I have. I know it came out. I love Judy Blume, obviously. Everyone loves.
Well, I interviewed the man who wrote that, and it's a similar story in that she sort of was adrift after her kids were born and sort of found this. I mean, she started by making clay puzzles or something like that she would sell in New York City's shopping stores. But then she found writing.
And I had this idea before then that I would make jewelry and sell it on Oprah. I mean, I was like crazy. And all my friends were so sweet. They were like, sure. Have you ever made jewelry before?
How hard can it be?
Right.
You're sitting in Chicago?
Yes.
Is Chicago, Does Chicago have an impact on how you write? I know you moved for a while, right? You were gone for a while.
Yeah, that was a pandemic mistake. We briefly ran away to Williamsburg, Virginia. It lasted 18 months before we came running back. Chicago, there's no place. I'm such a Chicago cheerleader. It's like part of my social media presence is just I'm always cheerleading for Chicago. I don't know. I mean, I'd love to write a book set in Chicago, and it just hasn't happened yet. Or influenced by Chicago. I'd love to write a novel about the Iroquois Theater fire. But no one wants me to write that book because it's kind
of the Eastland disaster.
Or the Eastland. I would say Chicago just informs who I am. Right. And that informs how I write. But I can't imagine living anywhere else. Just the energy, the diversity, the pockets of tranquility that people don't understand are in this city, the beauty of it, and just the people and the theater. I mean, we go to the theater a lot. I mean, all that I truly believe fills up the creative bucket that every writer needs to keep filled with other people's art.
Well, we're glad you're back, but I will point out that when you were living in Williamsburg during the winter, you would post warm pictures to tease the rest of us. So.
It was beautiful. I would say that was beautiful to have trees blooming in the winter. Yeah. But I actually missed, oddly, I missed the snow and cold and slush.
There's something about that white ring around your feet with the salt where it's dried on your shoes, right?
Well, I mean, having the winter, the various different winter coats, you know, you have the pretty one that you go out in when it's not snowing, and then you have the one when it's only 25 degrees out, and then you have the one for when it's 15 below.
All right, let's go to England.
Okay.
I was telling my wife, Sharon, that I was reading this book about the King of England, his abdication, and Wallace Simpson, and she right away said, well, that story seems to have been done quite a bit, and it has, but you found a way to do it from a unique sort of angle. Explain that to me.
Yeah, I agreed with her. I mean, I had this idea in my file of ideas for a very long time, but something always prevented me from actively pitching it to my agent and my editor because I felt it had been told before. But then I realized that it hadn't in historical fiction. Now, obviously, there are many biographies of both women, particularly Wallace, and about the abdication, and it was touched on in The Crown. But when I got down to looking into it, it's the rivalry between Wallace Simpson, the American divorcee, for whom Edward VIII abdicated his throne, and Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, the mother of the future Queen Elizabeth II, who became known as the beloved Queen Mum. This juicy, juicy rivalry, the story told from their points of view only, that hadn't been done.
Yeah, there are a lot of different names here. So when we talk about Elizabeth, we're talking about Lilibet, Queen Elizabeth, our Queen Elizabeth's mother, the Queen Mother, as we saw
her. Yeah, it's very confusing. They had a tendency to name everybody after the same people over and over.
Right.
So Elizabeth Bowes Lyon in my novel is whom you might know and remember fondly as the Queen Mother of Elizabeth II.
Who didn't look like she had a mean political bone in her body, but in your book she does.
I think she was an extremely smart, manipulative political person. I don't think she aspired to have to deploy all that. I think she would have been quite happy had her husband, Bertie, who became King George VI after the abdication. I know it's so hard to keep straight as a royal fan, but I think she would have been quite happy had the abdication not happened. And she and her little family, including Elizabeth and Margaret Rose, would just have lived a very plush, royal, but comfortable, but non-eventful life. But once Wallace Simpson came along and started things happening and setting in motion what became the abdication, then I think Elizabeth very much rose to the occasion and saw the opportunity. They didn't seek it, but once it happened, I think she thought, I'll make a really good queen. And she also very much protected, I think, the crown, the monarchy, the royal family. She was very instrumental in protecting them from this perceived enemy in Wallace Simpson.
So we've got this feud between Elizabeth and Wallace. How true to history is it? And how do you document that? How do you make that work in a work of fiction?
Well, you kind of have to allow your imagination room. You know, you have to look at it and say, well, we know things that happened. What we don't know always is what was the reasoning behind the thing that happened? Who actually implemented the thing that happened? What was going on behind the scenes? That's what I love to explore as a novelist, because I can make it up, but it's always based on reading the actual history. In this case, there are many biographies of the women, but it was really interesting as I was reading these biographies, depending on who, on which book you were reading, Wallace was either a victim or the Jezebel of all time.
Interesting.
And Elizabeth was either the saint of all time or the most manipulative, conniving, I won't say the word, but on the throne. I mean, you know, it just, there's so many different opposite points of view about both women.
Do you have an opinion of which is which?
Well, I think they had more in common than most people want to realize. I think that had they met under different circumstances, they might have been very good friends, because they were very strong women married to much weaker Windsor brothers. And they both loved a good gossip, and they both had a biting wit. And there's a lot of that in my novel. It is great fun to read, I think, because of that. But I think ultimately I came down on the side of that that Wallace was more of a victim than we think, because I don't think she wanted the king to abdicate for her. Mm-hmm. I think she understood that that was going to relegate her to a pretty miserable life of exile and never being able to leave him, because she had left many men before. She was married twice before. And but I also think, though, that she bought in a bit to the delusion that David, the king, was offering her, that she could possibly be crowned. That was never going to happen, but I think he thought it could happen. And during that time period, she really bought into it. I think she disliked Elizabeth very much. They were opposite women.
They called her Cookie.
Yeah. The king and David and Wallace called Elizabeth Cookie.
And why is that?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why. The most widely accepted is just, and I don't want to trigger anyone, we live in a different time, but back then body shaming was kind of an art form.
Well, body was very important to Wallace Simpson too, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, David,
it's only natural. Yeah.
Yeah. Evidently both David, who was King Edward, and Wallace both might've had anorexia. I mean, both were extremely religious about dieting and exercising to keep their very, very, very thin all their lives. Whereas Elizabeth was a little bit more, you know, enjoying life, right? Not counting the calories, just enjoying the good things in life. And so she had a different kind of style and figure than Wallace and David. And that is most likely why they called her Cookie, because she just resembled, in their words, a fat.
There's another theory that you explore in the book, but we'll leave that for the readers.
Yeah, I'll leave that for the book.
David and Elizabeth knew each other before Wallace came into play. Yeah. Was Elizabeth in love with David, or did she want David in love with her?
You know, one of the interesting things that I don't think we know about this, if you only like have seen The Crown and that's like kind of your only background into the history of the abdication, is that when David was Prince of Wales, and he became Prince of Wales at a very young age, I think he was only like 12, when his father, George the Fifth became king. There's a lot of rules here. But anyway, David, in the 1920s, I think, when he was a young man and he was Prince of Wales and World War I was over, he was a glamorous, very handsome, dashing young man who was world famous and attracted a lot of female attention. So we have to remember that, because we don't particularly remember that when we're talking about the abdication, right? So like almost every young woman in Great Britain, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, who was the daughter of an earl, so she was of the aristocracy, and so sort of in this circle, I think she had a crush on him. I think every young woman, there was a very popular song of the time called I've Danced with a Man Who's Danced with a Girl Who's Danced with the Prince of Wales. That's how popular he was. So I think she did have some, at least a crush on him.
One of the things I like about this book, too, is that we hear just a couple of times from Queen Mary. And just to throw another royal name in there, but Queen Mary is David's mother, right? Yes. And Bertie's mother.
And Bertie's mother.
And she's sort of manipulative herself. Tell me about her character in your book.
Yeah, so Queen Mary was the wife of King George V. She had actually been the fiance of his older brother when his older brother was Prince of Wales, and the older brother died. And Queen Victoria decreed that Mary, May, as she was called, would now be the wife of the next heir, next in line. So she was, you know, she was an English-born princess, granddaughter of George III, and very, very, very royal in an intimidating way, I think, all her life, and would do anything to protect the monarchy, and absolutely saw Wallace they were all very, very upset at the way David was behaving with Wallace Simpson, who was a twice, at this point, a divorced, married American woman. They very much saw her. I mean, David was supposed to marry a princess and have royal children, very much like what Prince William has done. And he kept falling for divorced Americans.
and it should be pointed out as well that divorce was contrary to the Church of England. So
yes, see, that's the thing. In that time period, the head of the king or the reigning monarch was always, is still the head of the Church of England. And in 1936, when the abdication happened, the Church of England did not recognize divorce. And Wallace Simpson, by this time, had divorced her British husband. I don't think she wanted to, but I think David made her, because obviously they couldn't get married until she divorced Ernest Simpson. The funny thing is the prevailing idea in the government, including people like Winston Churchill, were all like, well, let the king have his little cutie. That's what Winston Churchill called her. As long as he didn't marry her, nobody cared that he was having an affair with her, because that was pretty common among kings back then.
Okay, you want to hear a funny little story? And then later, the prime minister, I don't know if it was John Major or who it was, there was a ruling that the king could marry a woman who'd been divorced. And that, of course, cleared the way for Camilla Parker Bowles to marry Prince Charles. I was in the studio at WGN Radio at the time with Roy Leonard and Michael Caine.
Oh!
How weird is that? And
how is that? How did he feel about that?
I broke the story, and he's like, that is big. That is a huge development that has just happened.
Right. I mean, it famously, this is why Margaret could not marry Group Captain Townsend, right? Peter Townsend, back in the 1950s, because he was divorced. And so in 1936, the King of England could not marry a divorced woman. It did change very reluctantly. And you know what? Up until very recently, the palace did not even employ anyone who had been divorced.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Like, even after they changed it so that Charles could marry Camilla, as long as Elizabeth II was alive and running the show, it was very rare to have, very much frowned upon to, they just wouldn't hire divorced people until very recently.
I want to move back to Cookie, to Elizabeth for a second, only because you did something here that I want to ask you about. You had a couple times where you mentioned that she held back or did not hold back a royal burp.
Well, you're going to make him human, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Cookie was more of an earthy person, is what I'm trying to. This is the kind of, yeah. So she was fond of her alcohol quite a bit. The Queen Mum lived to be 101 and famous for her alcoholic consumption and capacity. And so I think that's just one of those.
It was fun. Okay, tell me about Tommy. Is it Lascelles?
Tommy Lascelles.
Lascelles, okay. We would have seen him in The Crown as well, I think.
He was very much in The Crown, and I absolutely loved the actor who played him. And he really was he loathed David. He used to be his personal equerry, accompanied him on many of David's famous around the world trips when he was Prince of Wales in the 20s and 30s. And just became very disgusted with his habits, David's habits of, you know, he wanted to play more than he wanted to rule, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think he really wanted to be king in a lot of ways. So Tommy came to this, became very integral in the whole, I think he was a spy. I think he was a plant within, because he had been the King George V's personal assistant, David inherited him in a way when he became king. And for a while, and then he got rid of Tommy. But I truly think Tommy was spying. A lot of people were spying on the new king and Wallace. There were palace spies all over the place reporting back to, I think, Elizabeth, Cookie, mm-hmm. and Queen Mary, and the government. Stanley Baldwin was the prime minister at the time. He was one of them for sure.
I like also the way you incorporate World War II in this, because you have to, but it doesn't become dominating. It very much is a, you know, it's there, the king and queen, Bertie and Elizabeth, out in the crowds in the West End, Wallace Simpson and David misstepping when it comes to sort of cozying up to Adolf Hitler. Hitler met Wallace Simpson. I don't think he ever met Queen Elizabeth, but he called her in your book the most dangerous woman in Europe.
He did call her that. Yeah.
Is that your work, or did he really say that?
He actually said that.
He did. Okay.
He did. Yeah. Wallace. So this is the dark stain against the Windsors. You know, some people might find them pitiable characters, you know, driven away from their home. They truly felt they would be allowed to return. I think David, the former king, never once thought he was giving up England mm-hmm. when he gave up the throne. He thought he would. But, you know, we have to understand how historical this was. There had never been a living monarch who willingly gave up his throne in England. Never had there been a living king, former king, and a current king. Never had happened. So there was a whole lot of what do we do with the situation? And the Windsors did not help themselves by deciding to go visit Adolf Hitler in, I believe it was 37 or 38, pictures of them meeting, palling around with him. Even though David was no longer the king and no longer representing the government, just like I think Harry and Meghan today, there still seemed to be some confusion from the world. They thought this was, you know, this is the former king meeting Hitler. So I guess he represents the government in some way, but he did not. And so when the war broke out, the government, along with King George VI and Elizabeth, decided they had to get the Windsors off the continent. We found out later, years later, this is documented, the Marburg files that were discovered right at the end of the war by the Americans, that there had been a plot by Hitler to work with the former king to get his brother to surrender to the Germans, and then they would set David and Wallace up as a kind of puppet mm-hmm. monarchy. And we don't know whether or not David and Wallace agreed to this. Pretty much know they were aware of this plot. They didn't say no. And at one point, David actually did indicate that it was good for England to be bombed, even if it meant the deaths of his former subjects, if that meant England would surrender sooner.
Which is an example of why it's dangerous to have a living former king.
Yeah,
right, that he might
absolutely.
Be placed.
I mean, they were terrified that so what happened was the government sent the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, as they were known by this time, to the Bahamas to live out the war as the governor of the Bahamas. So he was very, very far away.
And out of touch. I mean, there was no, of course, newspapers late and all of that. In the end, they became a pathetic couple. Is that fair?
I truly think so, yeah. And after the war, up until the war, I guess you could safely say, there might have been an opportunity for the British government to welcome the Windsors back to England and give David some kind of a PR job. Now, a lot of this sounds familiar, right? Because we're talking today about Andrew Mountbatten, who, you know, and right. Harry and Meghan. And there are a lot of similarities, but there are some differences.
Well,
and,
I wanted to ask you that. I mean, is this history repeating itself?
It is, though, when you think about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth at one point in the book says, she's talking about Charles, who's the Prince of Wales, I think, at the time. Yeah. And she said he should pick a wife before it's too late and he chooses the wrong one.
Right.
Right? That was foreteller of the future.
Yeah. And they were all very worried about that he waited too long, and then he did choose the wrong one, but it's because it was the one they wanted. But getting back to the Windsors, so after the war, when they discovered this plot, that Hitler's plot that included the Windsors, and the Windsors at least, and the Windsors at least being aware of it and not complaining, that ended any chance of the former king being allowed to return to England and have any public role. And so that is when I think things got really, really sad and pathetic for the Duchess of Windsor.
I want to go back to explore a little bit more the idea of history repeating itself. So we've got Charles marrying late in a way, the way David did. We've got Harry, who is, you alluded to it, but exiled in a way that maybe the king, a former king, was. I mean, tell me what we can learn from the Windsor affair, or how the Windsor affair can help flesh out what's happening today in England.
A lot of people said when Meghan Markle, you know, the divorced American, became engaged.
That woman?
Yes, became engaged to Prince Harry. A lot of people immediately compared her to Wallis Simpson. I think unfairly in a lot of ways, simply because she was an American and divorced. Now, there are a lot of differences. Meghan Markle had a successful career. She didn't need Prince Harry to buy her the jewels and raise her profile the way Wallis did, right? So there's a difference there. And I think, but I think the similarity is, so when Meghan and Harry famously, they had this summit, I think they call it the Sandringham Summit, where they met with Queen Elizabeth II and the then Prince Charles and said, we'd like to do this halfway. We'd like to be able to earn our own money and have our own careers, but still remain part of the royal family. And they said, you can't do it that way. Because if you're part of the royal family, allegedly, you're not supposed to be making money from being a part of the royal family. Now, Andrew Mount Windsor had other ideas. So famously, that was the moment the British, the royal family said, you can't have it both ways. And Harry and Meghan chose to leave Britain and come to the United States. I still think they're finding their way and they're not understanding. There are too many similarities, I think, with the Windsors in their doing these kind of pseudo royal tours like they just did to Australia, and people like, well, you didn't want to be a royal. Why are you doing royal tours and expecting to get, you know, there's still some, there is a lot of resentment, I think, on both sides. But I think the difference is they chose that, whereas the Duke and Duchess of Windsor did not choose to be exiled from England. And I think, they never, I mean, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor's life would have been much better had they chosen to devote themselves to, I don't know, charity or philanthropy or something, which Harry and Meghan are trying to do in some ways. But instead, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor just wanted to live like a king and queen without having all the burdens of that. And they relied, and so they lived a very empty life of
I was in London a few weeks ago, and I can tell you that Meghan Markle is referred to her as that woman, or is referred to, you know, in a derogatory way, as someone who's broken up the family.
But it's unfair, because I think there is a difference, and there is a racial component to the way the press treated Meghan. Absolutely, even though they wanted to deny. But, you know, when you compare Meghan and Wallis and Queen Elizabeth Bowes-Lyon and Princess Kate, there are a lot of similarities. You know, both Kate and Elizabeth Bowes-Lyon are English roses, right? You know, and they're strong women, but I think they wield their power in ways that are more, quote unquote, acceptable by traditionalists, meaning very family oriented, very feminine, very behind the scenes in ways versus Meghan Markle or Wallace Simpson, who were Americans. And I think there is an energy and a confidence there that doesn't mix well with traditionalists in Great Britain.
Melanie, I enjoyed the book very much. I like that you worked in some of the characters from your other books, like Lindbergh was in this. Lindbergh made it to Paley's, of course.
They were at that dinner.
Oh, I don't doubt that you made it up. I didn't see Tom Thumb. I was looking for Tom Thumb.
Sorry. No, not there anymore.
I think of you every time I go to Milwaukee, because I did not know until I read your book that he died in a fire there, right?
Yeah. You know, when I had a book signing up there, but this is referring to my novel, the Autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb, based on a real woman, 32-inch tall, Lavinia Stratton, Mrs. Tom Thumb. And there was a horrific hotel fire in Milwaukee when they were staying there. And these were tiny people, 32 inches tall. They could have perished in this fire. A lot of people did. And it kind of led, I think, later on to the death of Tom Thumb itself. But anyway, when I had a book signing there for that book, I can't if it was a Boswell Books or somewhere up in Milwaukee, Someone brought me a diorama they had made of Mr. and Mrs. Tom Thumb in the fire.
Oh, my.
And they had made it before my book came out. It's like, this is just somebody who did this for a hobby, I guess. But yeah, it's that famous in Milwaukee.
I enjoy talking to you. I always do. And I look forward to what's next, Melanie.
Thanks, me too.
Do you know what's next?
I have some ideas.
Let's kick them around. What do you think? Well, I'll tell you.
I can't.
All right. Well, we'll still have to have that cocktail at the rooftop of the Lincoln Hotel.
Love that place.
I know you do. We've talked about it. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Go back to your typewriter, your idea, your notebook,
and typewriter.
Find something for us. Go back to your quill pen.
Be old.
I didn't call you old. I just said you started writing later than most people do. I mean, you look great for your mid-30s, I think.
I think so. You too.
Okay. I think that's where we should end it.
All right.
This is Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're listening, and I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast. You can do that at Spotify or Apple Music or just about anywhere else you pick up your podcast, WGN Radio as well. I know, Melanie, you've subscribed, right? Or you will be today.
Of course I did, yesterday.
Okay, good. All right, we'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Sure.
And thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.